the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first matter, 2019-1323, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Thomas Nuff, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Vincent, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, Justices, may it please the court. Adam Vincent on behalf of Thomas Knuff, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. A fair trial is the fundamental component of our system of justice. And we all know what a fair trial looks like. It's one where relevant evidence is presented that speaks to the events in question, where inflammatory and prejudicial evidence and testimony is excluded, where the procedures dictated by law and the criminal rules are followed, where the rights of a defendant are ensured. In sum, it's one where we can have faith in the outcome. We can have faith in the conviction, we can have faith in the sentence, and in a capital case, we can have faith that the jury properly found that the ultimate punishment was appropriate. But that's not the kind of trial that was given to Mr. Knuff. Instead, his was a trial rife with evidence that was irrelevant to the events at issue, evidence with no probative value that could only serve to diminish his character in the eyes of the jury, evidence and testimony that could serve no purpose but to speak to his propensity to commit bad acts. It was a trial in which duplicative, inflammatory, and gruesome photographs were introduced, a trial in which the court refused to sever unrelated charges that only further served to paint this picture of Mr. Knuff for the jury as a bad guy who does bad things. And it was a trial where basic procedural rules were not followed. Numerous pretrial conferences and hearings were held off the record. And so I want to talk first about some of that inflammatory and prejudicial evidence that came in to taint Mr. Knuff's character. The state painted a picture for the jury of Mr. Knuff. And the picture, in short, was this. Here's a bad father. Here's a bad brother. Here's a bad son, a drug addict, a criminal, a man who uses people for money, a man that people didn't trust. He's a bad person who does bad things. And if he does bad things like this, then he must have also committed murder. And this is not sort of a cut and dry case of overwhelming guilt where there's a clear understanding of exactly what happened on the night of the events in question. At trial, Mr. Knuff put forth a theory of actual innocence as to the death of Mr. Mann and of self-defense as to the death of Ms. Capobianco. And there's evidence in the record to support that theory, that there was a strained relationship between Mr. Mann and Ms. Capobianco, that Mr. Mann wanted money from her, that she hated living with him, needed money, that she may have been planning to potentially scam him in some way. This comes from text messages in the record. A piece of paper found at the scene that had date of birth, social security number, identifying information of Mr. Mann and his bank account information. That he was nervous about her getting access to his social security check, which was his only source of income. And Mr. Knuff's version of events is essentially that he returned home that night on May 11th, found John Mann mortally wounded, and then Ms. Capobianco attacked him as well, and in self-defense, he killed her. It's a story he consistently told police, and not just police, even just a week after the crimes, he was in the hospital and told the same story to a nurse there. And that's how it comes through, of course, in Mr. Knuff's statements to others, is how the story plays out, because there were only three people in the house that night, and of course, only one of them is here with us today to provide any version of events. In contrast, the state's theory at trial was that Mr. Knuff, having being on parole, Ms. Capobianco also on parole, that they could not live together, or that Mr. Knuff so believed that. And when she wouldn't leave, an altercation occurred in which he killed her, and then as a result of that, he killed John Mann because he was a witness to the crime, all in theory so that Mr. Knuff could have a place to live. Of course, he did not continue to live in that property after their deaths. He sort of moved on. So there are two theories presented to the jury at trial, and in the absence of truly damning or sure evidence of what, in fact, happened that night, the state turns to this prejudicial character evidence, inflammatory testimony, that just paints Mr. Knuff and his character as a bad guy, as a person who has bad behavior, who has a bad history, the kind of person that we would think does bad things. The jury might think he's so bad, you know, maybe he'll commit murder. So to touch on a few of those things, sort of highlight, then I'll talk about a few more in detail. They elicited a testimony that he used people for money, that he'd gotten his mother to send him money in prison or perhaps sent money to other people. He had been in prison for 16 years prior to these events. He had been out for about a month. The state even says at sidebar, when objection is raised to this matter, the state says, and I quote, "It's relevant to what he is capable of doing, that he is capable of, you know, getting his mother to send him money or send money to other people," the implication being that it was, you know, somehow nefarious, but that it's relevant to show what he's capable of doing. They elicit testimony that he didn't contact his son right away after he got out of prison. They elicit testimony that others came to not trust him or didn't trust him.
Most of this was never objected to, right?
Actually, in fact, Your Honor, what I'm talking about here, all of this was objected to.
There was no objection to the testimony about his son.
There's objection to some of the testimony about his son, but not all of it. It's true, Your Honor, there is testimony discussed in the briefing that was not objected to that is also prejudicial. What I want to focus on here is the testimony that there was objection to. And the list I've sort of provided so far is stuff that objections were provided to in the record. But here, let's jump to one specific. Let's talk about Dexter. It's a TV show some of you may be familiar with, ran 8 seasons. It's about a serial killer who dismembers people's bodies and then hides the bodies away. In testimony by Mr. Knuff's son, and it's elicited specifically by the state. The state asks, "Oh, was there a TV show you and your father discussed?" And his son says, "Oh, my dad and I would talk about Dexter all the time. It was a show my father liked a lot." And the son goes on to say, specifically in his testimony, not that his father said ever to him, "Oh, you know what? I like Dexter. He chops up bodies. I'm going to go buy a hacksaw and chop up these bodies." His son says, "When my father had the idea to and talked about dismembering these bodies, something Mr. Knuff never in fact did, that his son thought maybe that's where he got the idea, that that's a line his son drew, not a line that Mr. Knuff drew himself or ever spoke
but
about."
Isn't the prejudicial thing not that he liked Dexter, but that he considered dismembering bodies, that he discussed that with his son?
So I think there's sort of two things here. Of course, the fact that he discussed...
I mean, in the context of talking about dismembering bodies, a mention of Dexter really doesn't change things much one way or the other. It's kind of the dismembering bodies that seems pretty prejudicial.
Well, Your Honor, I would say bringing up Dexter, it draws this line for the jury that sort of starts to compare the defendant to, you know, this sort of famous serial killer from television. And it's something the state latches onto. In closing, they come back to it, and they sort of mischaracterize it. They say, and I'm quoting almost verbatim here, they say, he goes and buys a hacksaw. He tells his son about Dexter. What kind of person does that? I mean, that's the question the state is asking of the jury throughout this entire trial with all this prejudicial evidence. What kind of person thinks about dismembering a body? What kind of person?
But that's the point. What kind of person thinks about dismembering a body? And that was the evidence. So it doesn't seem much prejudicial. Well, it's prejudicial because, but there's nothing unfairly prejudicial about that.
I think to draw a line between a defendant and, again, a serial killer from television that the jury may be familiar with, to paint a person in that way, I think is inherently prejudicial to a defendant. To say, here's this guy who thinks he's, essentially you're saying, here's this guy who thinks he's like this hotshot serial killer from TV you might know. But this isn't the only prejudicial character evidence in the record. I mean, again, they bring in information about drug use, okay? They bring in a toxicology screen from a week after the crimes. They elicit testimony from Ms. Stoner about what she understood to be his drug use before he was in prison, and what she understood his drug use to be after he got out of prison, which she understood him to be clean in that time. And then they elicit testimony from her about his behavior. Did he seem paranoid? She says she did. They elicit testimony from this Uber driver who says on the record, you know, that Mr. Knuff seemed sketchy, that he talked about spending time in prison, that the Uber driver thought he was weird, that he was concerned, you know, maybe feared for his safety, that he seemed paranoid. and all this stuff, it just paints this picture for the jury of a guy who does bad things, right? Paints a picture for the jury that he was a bad father to his son, a bad brother to his sister. You know, they had these disputes about family money. But none of this stuff is relevant to the deaths of Mr. Mann and Ms. Capobianco. It bears nothing on the case whatsoever. You know, the state asserts about the Dexter stuff, for example, that it was relevant to show where he got the idea. How the relevancy, where he got the idea is, it was truly irrelevant. It doesn't matter. He had the idea to dismember the bodies, right? If it came from Dexter or not, it doesn't matter. But to introduce him and compare him to a serial killer from television is inherently prejudicial. Similarly, the state says, you know, when they bring in all this testimony about his relationship to his son, to his sister, the state says, oh, it's to show what the relationship that they had. But the relationship, the nature that it was a bad one with his son or a strained one with his sister, again, has no bearing on the facts that are in question. It has no bearing on the deaths of Mr. Mann and Ms. Capobianco. It's equally true for the drug use that I discussed before, you know, and his perceived state of mind a week or weeks after these crimes. People say he was paranoid. You know, the state asserts that he was a manipulative mind. And that he did all these bad things that, again, don't bear on the events in question. They don't bear on the aggravating factors. They don't bear on whether or not he committed these murders. And I want to turn now to talk about the charges that they were not severed in this case, a string of breaking and entering charges, because he, a week after these deaths, broke into a couple hair salons, a hair salon and a nail salon. And these B&Es are totally unrelated to the murders. The state asserts that they needed to bring them in to establish identity of the killer through this Jeep that is seen in the videos of the hair salons and that had also been seen at the house. But identity was never a question here. There's no dispute that Mr. Knuff was in the house that night. There's no dispute that there were three people in the house. He was the only one that left. The dispute is about what went on. So the idea that these B&Es need to be part of this trial to establish his identity is simply not true. And their presence in the trial just sort of further muddies the water for the jury. It says to the jury, well, here are these B&Es. We know he did for sure. We got video of him doing them. We're going to play it for you. And if he did these B&Es last week, or this week, maybe last week, the week before, he killed two people. Who's to say? He does drugs. He's estranged from his son. He maybe swindled his mother out of money. All this stuff to say to the jury, you know, if this guy does this kind of stuff, maybe he's the kind of guy who also commits murder.
I'm not sure I understand your objection. He was charged with this. So is your objection that this wasn't properly joined? Are you saying, it sounds like you're saying this is other acts evidence that shouldn't have come in. But yeah. Obviously he was charged with it, so it probably came in.
He was charged with it, Your Honor, and it should have been severed in a capital case like this. It, essentially, these charges being present, charged at the same time, effectively acted as impermissible other acts evidence. You know, this is a capital case where we recognize the need for heightened protections, heightened procedures in the courts, and to bring these charges in that are totally unrelated in time, they're totally unrelated in, you know, there's no modus operandi that follows, there's no, you know, thumbprint or fingerprint of similarity to them whatsoever. And there, of course, you know, there's the argument for efficiency and joinder, but in a capital case, the risk you run in joining these charges is, again, to just say to the jury, well, he's guilty of these breaking and enterings, so maybe he's also guilty of these murders.
Do we know when he is alleged to have torn up the carpet and tried and put the bodies in the construction bags and tried to hide what he did? Did that happen right after the murder, or did it happen later?
It did not happen immediately after. It was some days after that he moved the bodies into the next room. I apologize, Your Honor, the exact date escapes me. But it was some days later that he moved the bodies into the back and sort of tried to cut off the carpet and that kind of stuff.
How close in time was that to the breaking and entering?
I can't say with certainty, Your Honor. I apologize. There's nothing to suggest that the B&Es were in any way related to that. The record suggests he performed the breaking and enterings to get money from the cash registers. But the money used, for example, to, you know, buy the instruments that he used to cut up the carpet and stuff, for example, came from his girlfriend at the time. So So again, there's no line between the crimes or, you know, the acts around them, or, you know, the alleged crimes and the acts around them and these B&Es. It only serves, again, to prejudice him to the jury. I also want to talk about photographs. They're quite gruesome photographs of the bodies in this case. I mean, photographs of the deceased are always quite gruesome. There were 28 photographs of each deceased individual in this case, so a total of 56 photographs. There were 15 knife wounds on Mr. Mann and 6 on Ms. Capobianco. I mean, this court has recognized that, of course, if there's probative value in a photograph being entered into the record, then it is appropriate. But that repetitive and cumulative photographs are inappropriate in this case. And the state asserts, you know, that it needed to enter every single one of these photographs into the record because...
I'm sorry. Can I just interrupt you?
Please.
What assignment of error was the improper that these things shouldn't have been joined? Is that one of your assignments of error?
Yeah, joinder is, oh boy, I want to say it's 6.
Okay, it is in here somewhere, okay.
Proposition 6, yeah.
Okay.
Did you have another?
But didn't the state say that these photos were necessary to show angles of the knife entry and decompositions of the bodies? I mean, didn't the trial court find that those were reasonable and that they weren't cumulative? Or, I mean, despite the gruesome nature of the photos, if you have decomposing bodies after a while, as you already alluded to, dead bodies or bodies of people who've been murdered are going to be gruesome by their nature for the most part. But weren't there reasons offered by the state as to why these particular photos were entered?
There were reasons offered by the state, Your Honor. But I would sort of counter that the photographs were still duplicative and cumulative in their number. Because again, we have, I guess, a total of 21 wounds between the two victims. We have 56 photographs in the record. The medical examiner's testimony includes in part sort of that, you know, there's decomposition of a level that there's only so much specificity that can be determined about angle of wounds and stuff like that. And so we would say, you know, of course the trial court found that it was proper to admit them, but we would ask this court to consider that these photographs were duplicative, prejudicial.
And if we did find that they were duplicative and or cumulative and prejudicial, would it be harmless error in this case?
I don't believe it would in this case, Your Honor. These are especially gruesome photographs, and this trial is so rife with prejudicial testimony and information brought in against Mr. Knuff. I mean, the whole trial is based upon painting the picture of this guy as a bad person and having these duplicative, gruesome photographs just sort of go further to sort of inflame the jury to say, well, these are disgusting.
What about, and I know we're kind of taking all over your brief, but what about the testimony regarding Mr. Knuff's attempt to have someone burn the home down? Because there was evidence there that would ruin his life.
Yeah, certainly that there is evidence of that in the record. I would say, you know, I mean, a lot of his behaviors after these deaths sort of raises the obvious question of, you know, why would a person who is innocent want to have these bodies burned or would drag them into the back room or cut up the carpet or whatever? And I would just say this, Your Honors, he had just been in prison for 16 years. By his own statements to people, he was terrified after this happened of going back to prison. He panicked. He essentially panicked. I mean, that reaction is not one that you or I may have, that sort of normal people would have, but, you know, this man has spent a life in the system. He had just spent almost 20 years in there. He's finally out. He'll have the opportunity to be a father to his son, to have, you know, he has a girlfriend waiting for him, his sister's outside. He can finally have a life, a normal life. And then not even a month after he's out of prison, this happens. And what he was terrified of happening to him, and the reason he fled and tried to cover up what happened, is what happened in the end. He's, you know, set to spend the rest of his life in prison. And does that excuse the behaviors that he took following these deaths? Perhaps not. But I think his history of trauma, his post-traumatic stress disorder, his history in DYS, all this time he spent in facilities and within the system, sort of inform an understanding of why a person would do some of these things he did after these deaths that a normal person, a person without those experiences, might not do.
Counsel, was there a record of every one of the proceedings made in this case?
No, there was not, Your Honor. There were, I believe, 19 total proceedings that were docketed, but were not put on the record whatsoever. And then also the jury.
And what's the reason for that?
There is no clear reason for that. No permissible reason is given. I mean, as this court is aware, in a capital case, everything should be on the record.
Do we know if those proceedings went forward in court, in open court, and we don't have a transcript for them?
As we understand the record, there were pretrial proceedings held in court that there is no record of, but recreation of the record did not sort of make that 100% clear.
Were any plea negotiations memorialized on the record?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I see my 20 minutes is up, so if there are no further questions, I will turn it over to the state.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Zalesnikar.
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. Frank Zalesnikar on behalf of the state. I'll be representing the state of Ohio in this matter. Let's start with Justice Donnelly's question regarding all the proceedings that were not recorded. This court has long held that all proceedings in a capital case should be recorded. However, the failure to record some proceedings will not warrant the reversal of a conviction unless the defendant can show three things. First, the defendant must show that the defense counsel either objected to the proceedings being held off the record or proffered something that happened off the record in open court to memorialize its objection. Also, the defense must also attempt to recreate the record. The Palmer case says pursuant to Appellate Rule 9, but that was decided in a time when death penalties went directly to the Court of Appeals, so that would be the analogous rule would be Supreme Court Practice Rule 11.03 D, which was not attempted in this case, that no statement of the proceedings was served on the appellee by the appellant in this case. So the first two things didn't occur. And the most important, which this court has stated, is that the defendant must also show that something happened off the record or the failure to record those proceedings resulted in some sort of material prejudice of the defendant. While the rule requires that the defendant show each and every one of those three things occurred, in this case, the defendant has not showed any of that has occurred. Therefore, the fact that the court journalized on its docket that some proceedings had occurred or might have occurred is not enough to warrant a reversal of the convictions. With respect to the photographs, there were numerous photographs, medical examiner photographs taken in this case. The state did a really good job of whittling down the number of photographs that were taken of the bodies of Mr. John Mann and Miss Regina Capibianco until we got to a number of 28 photos of each body that was presented at record and each presented at trial in each one of those photographs.
So how many were taken of each?
That's not in the record, but I'm more than happy to answer that if that's permissible. There were 422 ME photos in all. 92 were taken of John Mann's body and 90 were taken of Regina.
Were these all in the coroner's office or were some at the crime scene?
I just have 422 medical examiner photos. I know the medical examiner also took photos at the crime scene, I believe. But
so of the 56 are these all at the morgue, or are they some of them at the crime scene?
Oh, the ones that they complain of, the defense counsel, the exhibits 6 through 33, the photos of Regina, and exhibits 39 through 66, those are the photographs that appellant takes issue with, and those are all of various angles of the body, various angles of the individual knife wounds. There's a few pictures of them still in the body bags, a couple full body pictures of each. Not one of them.
Some are at the crime scene and some are at the medical examiners.
I don't believe any of them, the ones that the appellant takes issue with, are taken at the crime scene. They're all photographs of the individual wounds taken during the autopsy. And those were...
But if I recall, some of those wounds, it was hard to tell whether it was from the actual force or from the decomposition of the body because they were left there for so long.
Yes, and I believe that there was testimony, and this was another reason that the photographs were used. They were to illustrate the medical examiner's testimony. And I believe the medical examiner testified with respect to her findings, with respect to each one of those photographs. Mm-hmm. So not only did the photographs illustrate, again, not one of them are duplicative or cumulative, and what you didn't hear from appellant was which ones that they took issue with, which one was duplicative, which one was cumulative, because again, they each documented separate injuries, separate angles, and it was the state's responsibility. The state had a burden to demonstrate how these individuals were murdered. Now,
but it also went to offenses against a corpse, too.
I believe that the issues with respect to the photographs were to demonstrate the manner in which these individuals were murdered. For example, one of the issues that was in dispute in this case was the manner of death and how they died. You have to remember that the defendant's argument, his defense was that Regina, who was 5'2", is the one who murdered John Mann, who was 6'5". And then he ended up murdering Regina. That was his defense. And what these photographs demonstrate, and what the photographs needed to demonstrate, that someone that short would not be able to inflict the types of wound on John Mann that the photographs demonstrate. So that was another reason why the photographs were introduced in the manner in which they were. Each injury needed to be documented, and each injury needed to be testified to by the medical examiner. So again, what you didn't hear from the appellant was which of the photographs were duplicative, which one of them were repetitive, because none of them were. Were they gruesome? They weren't nice. They weren't pretty to look at. That's for sure. But we don't try these cases in a vacuum.
The trial court said he was 5'11" in her entry.
I believe his criminal history, we got the height of John Mann at 6'5", but I believe by the time that his body had been autopsied, it had whittled down to 71 inches, so that might have been where the trial court got the 5'11 number, but he was a tall individual, and I believe at some point his criminal history indicated that he was 6'5 at one point, and Regina was 5'2". And Regina, by the time her body had decomposed, I think her body had whittled down to a length of 5 feet. So that might have been where the 5'11 came from.
Thank you.
So that is respect to the photographs. With respect to the motions to sever, regardless of what defense counsel says, the break-ins at the nail salons that occurred about a week later were not irrelevant and totally separate. What we have after Mr. Knuff murdered Regina and John was he spent about a month, maybe like 3 weeks, attempting to find ways to cover up this crime scene. And one of the things he used to cover up the crime scene, to conceal the crime scene, is we have testimony from a neighbor who lived on Nellwood, who lived on the house on the street behind behind the Nellwood residence, who saw Mr. Knuff back that a white Jeep, which belonged to his son, which belonged to Knuff's son, back the Jeep to the Nellwood residence and start taking boxes out of the house and putting it in the Jeep, which Knuff later told his girlfriend that he was taking that stuff to his childhood home in Brunswick. But we know that that Jeep was used in the appellant's long odyssey of attempting to destroy this evidence or conceal this crime scene and taking any responsibility for what he did. And the way we got to that, the way that we found that Jeep and the way that Jeep was discovered, so this was necessary to show that this Jeep, which was used as a criminal tool in this case, was also used 7 days later by the same person, the appellant, in the nail salons. And the way that law enforcement discovered that Jeep was once there was video surveillance of the Jeep at the nail salons, taken from, I believe it was Godmother's Pizza. They had a surveillance video which showed the Jeep and Knuff. They think law enforcement made that public. And then law enforcement then got calls from Sergeant Dunbar from the Ohio State Patrol and appellant's sister advising police that that is Thomas Knuff. And then police were able to identify that on May 17th, I believe it was May 17th, May 18th, he was then found on I-71 with a gun to his head, or at least alleging to have a gun to his head. That's what the trooper got the call from. And he was on I-71. It appeared that he was having some sort of psychiatric breakdown. And he ended up in Medina Hospital. And when he spoke to Sergeant Dunbar, he told Sergeant Dunbar that he had dropped his white Jeep off at Plum Creekway in Akron. And that is how law enforcement discovered the Jeep and found the Jeep. So this would have come in, this would have been necessary to come in, even if these cases had been severed and tried separately. And so the jury had been made aware of how the law enforcement came across this Jeep that had been used in both of these crimes as some sort of course of conduct. Furthermore, with respect to the 404B other acts test when it comes to joinder. Also, the evidence for each of the offenses, the murders and the nail salon break-ins, the evidence to each was simple and direct. They occurred on two separate dates. They required separate witnesses, separate evidence. There was no way that the jury would be confused by the evidence presented to both of the with respect to both of the crimes. It was one big course of conduct that the appellant engaged in afterwards. Because we have to remember, one of the things that the state used as evidence was the fact that Mr. Knuff attempted to conceal the evidence of this crime. That is replete within the record. And his desire over the next 3 weeks after he murdered Regina and John was to conceal this crime. He even told police at one point during his interviews that all he can think about during those 3 weeks was how he can get away with it. You know, and he admitted that he messed up, and I believe his quote was, messed up a pretty good crime scene.
Where is that in the record, the comments to the police officers?
I believe that is in the interview with the police on June 29th. And I can tell you, here it is, Exhibit 1380-A. Where he speaks to the police. I believe that was on an interview either June 29th or June 30th. But
he never said what happened. Is that correct? I mean, the state's story of events or motive for the crimes was, I think, that they got to an argument because one couldn't live with the other, really don't know why these took place. I mean, Mr. Knuff says that Ms. Capobianco killed Mr. Mann, and then he killed her in self-defense. So that's his story.
That's one of his stories.
Okay, so but the state's theory is, does the state really know?
No, we can never really know exactly.
I mean, but there's no evidence of,
There's evidence in text messages about the strained relationship between, you know, Regina and John, and as well as Regina and especially the appellant, especially on the night of the murders. So no, we don't. What we do know is that Mr. Knuff told multiple stories. Contrary to what defense counsel said, Mr. Knuff told multiple stories of what happened that night to multiple different people. For example.
Oh, no, go ahead. For example.
Oh, for example, he told, right after it happened, he tells Alicia, his girlfriend, that he was, I believe, in the basement of the house, and then two drug dealers came in. They got in a fight with, John and...
So at one point, he never killed anybody.
I think he's always admitted to killing someone, but it depends on who. Like, he tells Alicia that he comes up and there's drug dealers and they stole John's car, which was a lie because he eventually admitted to the police that he's the one who stole John's car. But he says they stole John's car and then Regina got in a fight with John and she stabbed him and then he killed Regina in self-defense. That's what he tells Alicia. A couple days later, his son comes over the house. He calls his son over the house. And while they're out in the car, he tells his son that there's two dead black people in the house that he killed. And his story to his son at that point was that he was in the basement, and then two black guys came in, attacked John and Regina, killed John. Regina took off. She was somewhere else, he said. And then he had to kill one of them. And then he tells his son he had to kill the second one in self-defense. That obviously was a lie. To him, he told the psychiatric nurse Brian Gardner that his friend John had been murdered by a prostitute, and then he killed the prostitute. I think that at one point he tells the police, which differs from the story that
okay,
from
Ale-
get, I mean, I can keep going
gist.
On, but
I see.
Yeah,
I get the gist.
So yeah, I mean, it's replete. The records replete that this for 3 weeks, all he tried to do was not take responsibility, and that comes clear from his testimony, the testimony presented that all he wanted to do was conceal the crime scene. He told his son that after he told his son about the two dead black people that was in the house, that he wanted to cut their fingers off and chop their fingers off and dismember them. There's evidence that, like I just mentioned, the neighbor who saw him emptying out the house, attempting to clear the crime scene out. He tells Alicia, his girlfriend at the time, he wants to do the same thing. And what he does there is he tells her, he has her drive her to the Walmart in Parma, where he ends up buying X-Acto knives and hacksaws. And he tells Alicia that he's going to use the hacksaws to dismember the bodies. And let's not forget the fact that after all of that didn't pan out or he didn't go through with that, he writes a letter to a friend of his named Bob Lugo, telling Bob Lugo, hey, there's something in that house on Nellwood that will put me away for life if the police ever discover it. I want you to go in there with a nice, and he gives a big detailed explanation of how he wants him to burn down the house, go get a big thing of gas, go in the house, dump it all over the place, especially in the bedroom in the back, and set it on fire. And I will split the insurance money with you when I get back to Youngstown or Austintown or wherever he was planning on going afterwards. And that letter was written in his handwriting, was delivered to Alicia, and was eventually ended up in the hands of law enforcement, and which was read and introduced into evidence as Exhibit 1351. So there was.
So what do you say in response to your friend on the other side that this is really a conviction based on bad character evidence?
Well, I believe a number of the things that he mentions, we miss the context. Let's go through all the stuff that he mentions in his brief. Now, with respect to the fact that there was evidence presented at trial that he had been in prison, his defense attorney raised that for the first time in his opening arguments, because the jury was not surprised to hear that Mr. Knuff was in prison.
And he mentioned that he had problems with Regina because she was using drugs and he was on post-release control, and he couldn't have that in the same house he was living in, correct?
I believe that was one of the issues which would have which was brought through in the text messages, I believe.
Right. So it makes sense that he would be that is not you know, a dreadful thing that the jury knew that he'd been in prison, because that's relevant.
Well, it was completely in context, because and again, his defense attorney recognized that because he brought it up in the opening arguments, because in order to establish the relationship he had with Regina, because they started started a pen pal relationship,
right,
with each other when he was in when they were in prison back in like 2004. They were both in prison. They started a pen pal relationship. That's how they knew each other. You had to establish the fact that why was he living with Regina and John, and how they got that. How did he meet his girlfriend? His girlfriend, Alicia, she was a therapist at Trumbull Corrections when he was an inmate there. And that's how he met her, and that's how that relationship evolved. And she was probably one of the biggest witnesses in this entire trial, because she was the one that he confided in. She was the one that he was manipulating and attempting to use her as a conduit to help conceal everything. And that was when Alicia eventually told police that she stopped believing his stories and began to cooperate with the police. I believe that was around June 23rd. And she began giving the letters that he had constantly been writing her over to the police. And that's how law enforcement especially got that Bob DeLugo letter that has the solicitation of the arson in it. So the prison was relevant. The fact that he was a bad brother and father, none of this was brought out to determine, to explain, and nor did the prosecutor ever say he's a bad brother or he's a bad mother, or he's a bad brother, he's a bad father, therefore he committed this. No, what that was established, and his relationship with his son was relevant to explain why his son, the relationship that he had with his son, because you have to remember that he had been in prison almost his son's entire life, and his son didn't really know him. And you have to explain why his son was willing to lie to the police and lie for his father, especially after his father, who he had just started spending time with after his release, told him that he had murdered two people. Why would a teenager in high school lie to the police and cover for his father? Well, and that is explained based on the relationship that they had. So all of that was for context with respect to the relationship of between the father and son. With respect to the fact that he had was a drug addict and mental issues, at no point did the state ever say, look, he's a drug addict, he murdered these people. At no point was there ever any evidence brought forward that he was high or he was intoxicated when he murdered Regina and when he murdered John Mann. That was never what that was brought out for. Again, we have to explain how he ended up on May 17th in Medina Hospital. We have to explain what was happening on I-71 when Sergeant Dunbar got the call with respect to a man with a gun to his head saying, I'm going to kill myself, I don't want to live anymore, and having this seemingly psychotic breakdown. We have to explain why he was talking to a psychiatric nurse at Medina Hospital at the time. So that was relevant with respect to that. It brought context of how we ended up in that situation. With respect to the Dexter reference, again, we went through to establish all of the evidence of Mr. Knuff attempting to conceal the crime scene and take any responsibility for what he did.
So, and what was the factual basis for offenses against a corpse, the two counts?
The factual basis for the offenses against the corpse, it was based on the evidence of him attempting to conceal the crime scene, dragging the corpses from one room to another, burying them under the garbage, letting them rot for how long was it? I think it was a month and a half in the hot sun, in a hot house with no air, over the month of June. So I would believe that would be the basis for any abuse of the corpses. But that was with respect to the Dexter references, I was getting at. Again, one of the big things in this case was his attempt to conceal the crime scene and avoid any responsibility for what he did. And one of those things that was brought up was the fact that he calls his son up the next day and he tells his son that he wants to chop off the fingers and stuff. And this was in context of his son recognizing that his father had been a big fan of Dexter, and that Dexter was a television show where the serial killer would, after he would murder someone, one of the big things in the show was he would dismember the bodies in a certain way and clean up the crime scene. That was one of the things about Dexter. Like, he cleaned up the crime scene very well and made sure no one was able to, you know, discover it. At no point did the state say that he was a serial killer. At no point did the state use the Dexter reference as to say, look, he's a serial killer like the man in Dexter. No, it was limited to just the, look, this man, where does somebody get the idea of chopping off fingers and cutting up bodies and hiding and cleaning up a crime scene and concealing a crime scene? Well, we have the Dexter reference, and that's exactly what that was all used for. If there's any other questions, I would just ask this court to affirm the sentences of the trial court, which imposed death, with the exception to the one assignment of error where the court imposed court costs in its judgment entry after everyone waived it.
Let me ask one question. Sure. What's the factual basis for the burglary and kidnapping?
Okay, well, the burglary, the aggravated burglary occurred when, so he was he had obviously permission to be at the house, but there's case law, and it's cited in my brief, that says that once you are, if you have permission to be at a house, your permission to be there is presumably revoked the minute you begin assaulting someone. So that permission was, the minute he began assaulting John and Regina, was revoked the minute he began to assault them. So that's what that was the basis for the aggravated burglary, that he was in the house where he had no permission to be after he began assaulting them, and then he ended up murdering them both. With the respect to the kidnapping, this did not occur over a short instantaneous number period of time. What we have is, we have John Mann, who was stabbed 15 times. You have Regina, who was stabbed 6 times. This did not occur over a short period of time. It was clearly drawn out.
What is short to you?
Well, I mean, let's look in the situation of a firearm murder, like 15 shots, 6 shots. I mean, you got maybe 10 seconds to get off 15.
If you get them off repeatedly.
Exactly. But and I believe the case law is clear that, like, when you have someone who's been murdered and there's multiple stabbings, there's multiple injuries, and again, this goes to another explanation of why the state needed to demonstrate the multiple stab wounds, that they all occurred, because the more stab wounds, the more it indicates a more drawn out murder. And during that time, either of them could not leave. And also, during one of the interviews, I believe it might have been June 29th or June 30th, he tells police officers that while he was murdering Regina, while he was killing Regina, that he held her down and refused to let her leave. So that was the basis for the kidnapping charges. If there's no other questions, I would just ask this court to affirm the sentences and convictions imposed by the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vincent, you have 9 minutes and 42 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to discuss briefly the stories Mr. Knuff told, he did tell different stories to his son and his girlfriend than he told to police and officials, but the story he told to the nurse a week after the crimes is almost identical to the story he told police consistently. Now, he said that the person who attacked John in that story was a prostitute. He didn't refer to her as Regina by name when he talked to the nurse, but the record supports the fact that Regina performed sex work through the internet, through Facebook or Craigslist, Backpage, these kind of things. So the story he told sort of what I guess I'll call officials was always consistent. The story he told police, the story he told this nurse at a hospital a week after. He did tell different stories to his family members. And I think an explanation for that that's reasonable is that, I mean, one, he's panicked, as I discussed before, but also he is both trying to desperately to figure out what to do and also wants to protect his girlfriend, his son, you know, from becoming implicated or involved in this in some way. Of course, that did not play out the way he hoped in the end. But the story he told the nurse, the story he told police was consistent. I want to also talk about, you know, the state says that a lot of this character evidence I discussed before, you know, that it never tried to say to the jury, oh, well, you know, he's a bad guy, he's a drug user. You know, they never said that explicitly, that it never says, oh, well, he must be a serial killer because of Dexter, et cetera. But the implication is there that when you bring in testimony about somebody's drug use years, decades before the crime, which they elicited from Alicia, I mean, it has no bearing on the relevance of the facts in this case. When you draw direct lines to a serial killer in media. I mean, the state in closing referenced back to the fact that Mr. Knuff had not called his son when he first got out of prison, and the state said to the jury, rhetorically, of course, but doesn't that tell you the character of a human being? You know, doesn't that tell you the character of a human being? And when the state referenced Dexter in closing, they asked, you know, what kind of person does this? I mean, this is the question they were eliciting for the jury. What is the kind of person who does all this stuff you've heard? Not, doesn't all this evidence add up to he committed aggravated murder on May 11th? It's, doesn't this person add up to the kind of guy who would do it? And that's exactly the kind of implication that we don't allow, you know, to put before the jury, to just say, he's so bad, he must have done it, so you need to convict him.
But weren't the, didn't the trial court specify specifically what the aggravating circumstances were and caution the trial court not to use other things to create an aggravating circumstance?
I mean, the trial court did specify the aggravating circumstances for the jury. And I mean, and, you know, provided the typical instructions on, you know, how the jury should view those aggravating circumstances. But the record is so rife with prejudicial evidence and testimony about Mr. Knuff's character. I mean, we just can have no faith that the jury sat there and didn't, that didn't impact their decision making whatsoever. You know, I mean, it obviously undermined any ability the jury might have had to believe Mr. Knuff's story, because they're told again and again, you know, that he's a liar, people don't trust him, he's a drug addict, he's a criminal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we can just have no faith in the conviction the jury returned, because the evidence they heard was so, I mean, there was just so much that was just simply about who he was as a person that had no relevance or probative value to the case. And that kind of, with that, with the amount of evidence in the case of that nature, there can be no faith in the jury's conviction in this case.
And you're speaking to the conviction phase or the mitigation phase or both?
Well, I mean, really both, but especially the conviction phase. I mean, I don't think we can have faith in the jury's conviction of him for committing these aggravated murders, because their decision in whether or not he was guilty of that was, I mean, based upon the evidence in the record, was very likely premised or at least heavily influenced by this idea that here's a very bad person who does very bad things, and one of those very bad things could be aggravated murder. Your Honor, if there's no further questions from the court, I will just conclude briefly. As I noted before, the state asked some simple and direct rhetorical questions in closing that illustrate the issues in this case. It illustrates the state's strategy. You know, doesn't that tell you what kind of character, doesn't that tell you the character of a human being? What kind of person does this? You know, what kind of person can take money from their family or uses drugs or isn't trusted by those close to them? What kind of person freaks out the Uber driver? What kind of person loses touch with their son or spends time in prison? What kind of person breaks into hair salons? You know, the answer they looked for, that the state looked for, is the answer that it got. And it was the jury saying a person who does all those things is a person who commits murder. But where this case and the jury is so poisoned by this irrelevant and prejudicial character evidence, the trial just simply hasn't been fair. We cannot have any faith in the outcome of that trial. And so we would ask this court to vacate and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you call a recess?